very nice to see a lot of people that we know come and share this with us. Identity is something that we have been thinking about for some time, and that we've been dreaming about for some time. And this is a sort of opening that we hope you will enjoy. It is incredible to have two people such as Alejandro and Stephen who come here to give their support and to celebrate this first moment. These are very interesting times in which we are living. Maybe they don't look sometimes like that, but they are. And they are very exciting if you are a teacher or a student. Yes, there are enormous changes happening in education. And we are very glad that you are here with us to share and to learn maybe a little bit more. And maybe these things get you thinking and you can consider taking them into the classroom. Just a short note. Last year, these are many wonderful things happened on the internet. The other type also. But for example, one of the great things that happened to me last year was that one day after following Alejandro Visitelli for a very long time in Facebook, Alejandro is a world-recognized speaker. He's been giving seminars and conferences in universities all over the world. And he's the author of Uno a Uno de Rivas en la Educación Digital that we assisted to the presentation in Feria del Libro last Monday. And he's a lot of important things, but maybe one of the most important things for me is that he's a terribly generous person. Yes, he shares all the time whatever information he finds, whatever information he considers that is going to be valuable to some other people. He shares it in Facebook all the time. And I sent him a message. I dared to send Alejandro Visitelli a message, inviting him to come and see what we were doing. And not only did he come and visit us, but he has become our strongest supporter and mentor in this new endeavor. So we are terribly thankful to Alejandro, and it means a lot to us that he supports us in this way. But I won't speak anymore. I will leave the floor to Alejandro and to Stephen. Okay?
Thank you, Gladys. The first time I used a computer was in 1980. Apple had just put into the market the Apple II, and the first time I saw a floppy disk, and I loved it, and 4 years later, in 1984, I bought my first computer. It was an Apple IIc. It was a wonderful little machine, but had not enough storage capacity, so I wanted to buy a hard drive. And the hard drive was 10 megabytes, and it cost at the time $1,500. So many things have happened from 98 to this time that we cannot tell. We are so happy that these things happened. And in 2008, I was invited by Diego Leal, which is a friend of both of us, a very young Colombian, who had accosted Stephen Downs the year before, and they started something called EduCamp. And EduCamps is a way of training teachers in Web 2.0 and other things that have to do with the internet in just one day. And it was unbelievable, the things they could do. So I didn't know Stephen himself, but I knew that he had been working with Diego. And a year later, we almost met in Madrid, at Internet en el Aula, It was something that the Spanish government did for teachers. There were 10,000 teachers at the same time, divided in four different cities. Stephen was in Madrid, there was in Santander, there were people in Barcelona and in Sevilla at the same time. And I started to follow what Stephen was doing. And I registered in one of his courses on connectivism and connected knowledge, the one he taught with George Siemens in 2008. They had over 2,000 students at the time. And it was one of the first courses that had dealt with the fact of personalized environments, hyper-personalized environments. So I met him finally in Barcelona last year. We had dinner together in a very fancy and beautiful restaurant with Doros Reich, which is another fantastic person working in Spain in this area. And I invited Stephen to write the prologue of our book. We have been doing an experiment last year at the University of Buenos Aires, which is called the Facebook Project. And we wrote the book, a collective book, which is called the Facebook Project and the Post-University, which is going to be introduced publicly tomorrow at La Feria del Libro at 3:30 p.m. And Stephen read some of the translations, the abstract translations, but he knew what we were doing. And he wrote this beautiful prologue, very long prologue, that endorsed what we were doing. He's a very generous person as well. And so we were very happy with the prologue. So we thought it would be nice to have him here in Buenos Aires for the first time. And so we had some talks with the Canadian embassy, which was generous enough to bring him down. And now Stephen has been in Cordoba, has been in Rosario, and now he's in, here in Pilar, and tomorrow he's going to be at the Fundación Telefónica in the morning, at the Feria del Libro in the afternoon, at another school later in the evening. No? We are really, really bringing the best of him. He's working like hell to please us. He's one of the most renowned authorities in personal learning environments. He wants us to believe again in schools, in knowledge, in teaching, but in a very different way than we have been doing up to now. He's devising, with a very generous endowment of the Canadian government, a new tool, which is going to be a very fantastic tool, because now we work, when we work in virtual education, we work with CMS and LMS, which are structures, tools that mimic the way we work in the real world, but they do it in a very, very unreasonable way. They force us to do things we shouldn't be doing in the virtual environments. Because he has a dual background. He has been studying philosophy for a long time. He has a degree in philosophy, but at the same time, he has a lot of knowledge in computer science. So he's in the best of the two worlds. He has bridged the separation between the two cultures. He didn't have to choose either to be in the humanities or to be in the sciences, but he put both of the things together. And now, for instance, he's very much interested in the functioning of the brain and how the brain learns and how the brain teaches. He has a lot of knowledge of the hard sciences, no? So he can do both. So I think it's really a privilege to be at the beginning of IDA Digital and to have Stephen Dallas among us. Very happy to have you here, Stephen. Thanks.
Well, thank you very much, Alejandro. And I was beginning to believe that introduction, which was very, very generous. So I guess we're being live streamed now. It looks like it's working. Hi, world. Welcome from Argentina. And if you're wondering, yes, this session will be done in English. Although somebody may come along at some later time to translate it into Spanish or whatever language you speak. It's interesting, Alejandro, that you mentioned the product that we're developing at NRC. I spent part of the time this afternoon when I wanted to be preparing this talk writing a longish description for our scientific ethics committee, because we are offering a course starting in June called Critical Literacies. And this course will be taught using connectivist principles. And we're doing research related to this course. And so, of course, we have to subscribe to research ethics procedures. And the ethics board wrote us back today a 2-page letter that said, in essence, we don't understand. What are you doing? We don't get it. Where's the content? How are you measuring this? And a bunch of other questions that suggested to me that they are still thinking about traditional courses being offered and traditional kinds of knowledge and learning. So I spent a good part of the afternoon writing more than a 2-page response. I think it came in closer to 4 to 6, describing all of this. And you are the beneficiaries of that, because the later part of the presentation consists essentially of what I responded to the ethics committee with. So, but we got miles to go between here and there. I want to approach this gradually and approach this, in a sense, gently. Some of you are familiar with the work that I've done in connectivism and personal learning. Some of you are not. And I want to move you from where you may be to a perspective where you can see the point of view that I have. And I'm not going to ask you to believe me necessarily. I mean, I want you to make your own judgments and draw your own conclusions. But my effort in this talk is directed toward explaining the thinking that I've gone through and that we've gone through in coming up with this form of learning. So, I am recording the audio, and this looks like it's working pretty well. So, there will be a Ustream recording, but even if that fails, there will be an audio recording. And this is all part of the principle of it, right? The principle of not just teaching, not just learning, but creating and doing new things on a day-to-day basis. But I get ahead of myself. So let me go back to my slides. There we go. And this is the real title. That picture there is from Rosario. I thought that it was a classic. It's actually, I guess it's graffiti down on the docks, but I just love it. It's just a brilliant piece of art. And so I'm really glad I managed to capture that. I think it's a brilliant piece. Other people think it's like vandalism, but I think it's a brilliant piece of art. So what I want to do to begin is to talk about connectivist learning. You'll notice the structure of the title of the talk, Connectivist Learning and Teaching. And it's important that we begin with learning. And for those of you who followed my presentation in Rosario, this part will be a bit familiar to you, but I won't spend as long with it. I want to talk about learning. I want to talk about how you, as teachers and professionals, learn. Because, I thought it was a helicopter. I always wait for the day that I'm giving a talk and the helicopters will come. Yes, I have a whole little world in there. I want to talk about the principles that you use in order to learn for yourself, or that perhaps you should use, using the internet to the best advantage. Because When you and I, for that matter, as professionals, need to learn something, we typically do not sign up for a 40-hour class. We don't have time to do that. We don't have the inclination to do that. So we need to take matters into our own hands. And so we organize our own learning. We organize our learning personally. And what I've determined over the years is that we organize it based on 3 major principles. Now, just as an aside, these principles do not describe the state of affairs of the world, right? They're not something to be memorized or anything like that. They're just a simple way that I've used to classify the material, just a way to get at the material. But I could have organized the same material in a different way, any number of different ways. So the first principle is usability, which I take to mean simplicity and consistency. Oh, I'm missing a principle. Am I? Yes. What? I'm sorry, I'm missing a principle. I must have deleted the very first slide off of my slides. That's okay. I remember the first principle anyways. That's a good thing. The first principle is interactivity, connection with other people. The second principle is usability, which I take to mean simplicity and consistency. And the third principle is relevance or salience, that is, learning that is relevant to you now. I want to talk for a little bit about these three principles, because it's easy to just say, oh yeah, here are these three principles, right? And you all go back home and say, oh yeah, we learned about three principles. But what do these actually mean in your day-to-day lives as professionals? So let's talk about interaction first. I mean, think about why we want interaction, and I think there's two major reasons. Again, there might be more, but these are the two that struck me as important. The first is we want human contact. We want to know that there's a real person at the other end of the line. It's what Terry Anderson talks about when he's talking about presence. It's a way of motivating ourselves. It's a way of engaging ourselves with the world. But it's not just that we want. We also want, that screen is gone blank there, by the way, with a little bit of white writing on it, which distresses me. Okay.
But it's just, it's okay. It's checking in the other computer.
Yeah. All right. See, I worry about all those people. Are there, in fact, people out there in the world watching us? Do you know?
Three people.
We have a worldwide audience of three. Well, we didn't really give them much warning, did we? Anyhow.
No, that's true.
But the main thing is we are getting a nice video recording. Although I should.
They're coming in, eh? Now we have five.
Okay, well, it takes time.
Just let Twitter work.
The second principle, or second reason we want interaction, is human content. We want to learn what other people have learned, in their own work. I did a study. I was creating a learning information and resource system for municipal officials in Alberta. These are mayors, town managers, people who run towns throughout the province of Alberta. And we surveyed them and we asked them, how do you learn what you need to know to do your job? And they answered overwhelmingly, I pick up the telephone and I call somebody else who's doing the same job. It was this getting material from each other was the main way that they learned. And so learning content from other people is a major reason for wanting interaction. Now, from what I have seen, you cannot depend on traditional learning for interactivity. It's very hard to get real interactivity in traditional learning, especially, I remember when I went to university, which was not that long ago, classes of, 50, 100, 200 students, I'd be sitting way in the back, because that's what I learned to do, sit way in the back and observe. And I had courses I never once talked to the professor. Learning in the traditional model is based on the broadcast. You have one person talking and everybody listens. And that's not bad from time to time. Here, we're doing it here, and that's okay for a short period of time. But imagine spending 40 hours doing that, if that's what they do in traditional learning. And even where there is interactivity, it's separated from learning. You see the design of learning management systems. This is expressed very clearly. The learning is in one place. The conversation is in another place. And again, when I went to university, not very long ago, I'd be in one place to sit and listen, and then we'd all get up and go to a separate room to have a conversation, which was very odd, it seems to me. And so we want forms of learning where the learning and the interactivity go together. How do you do that? Well, again, you can't depend on other people to build an interaction network for you. You have to build an interaction network for yourself. And the way to visualize that, to think about that, is to put yourself at the center of the interaction network. And to think of yourself at the center, almost like the spider in the center of a web, except, of course, you're not a spider. And then you reach out and connect to different people using different tools. Don't connect to things. Don't connect to objects. Don't connect to resources or courses. Connect to people. Because it's people that you want to talk to, and it's people that you will be able to get the best content from. And create the environment that suits you best. Some people like Twitter, they should connect with Twitter. Other people like blogs, they should connect with blogs. What you want in your personal network depends on what you want. It's not for me to stand up here and say, well, you need to do this, you need to do this, you need to do this. So all I can offer are some suggestions, but the idea here is to tailor your interaction to your own interests and needs. What are you good at? What are you comfortable with? For me, my interaction, my personal network consists mostly of a place to write, a place for me to post my thoughts in a blog or to use email or mailing list to interact at somewhat longer length with other people. For other people, not so much me, your personal network may be a way to send quick messages. I know many of you, probably all of you, have mobile phones. Anyone not have a mobile phone here? No, you all do. Anyone not use SMS here? You all use SMS? Yeah, see, I have a mobile phone. I might even have it. I do have it. It's turned off, as usual. And I almost never use SMS. But Skype, how many of you have heard of Skype?
Yes.
Yeah, pretty much everyone, yeah. I cannot go a day without using Skype, especially when I'm on trips. I Skype back home because, well, it's free and I have video. It's great. It's better than the telephone. And Twitter, well, everyone knows about Twitter. A lot of people use Twitter, and I use Twitter a little bit. Other people, when they want to interact, they use social networks like Facebook or MySpace or even things like Flickr, which is very much a social network based around photographs, or YouTube. There's a whole list of things that are social networks. Some are good, some are bad. Some charge you money, some are free, some were free and are now charging you money. Or you may use threaded discussion lists like the discussions in Moodle, or even live events. And we're doing a live event here on Ustream, but you could also use Illuminate or DimDim or any of a large number of other conferencing tools. Are we getting any comments on the... Nothing yet? No? Just sitting back and listening? I should read the baseball score, see how they react then. See if they notice. Now, again, you can't depend on other people to provide this interactivity for you. You have to take charge and do this yourself. And so I've come up with some, when I originally came up with them, I called them guerrilla tactics, but then I presented in Colombia and I couldn't use the word guerrilla. So I've decided to call them the connectivist way. And they fit into the connectivist spirit, but they're a little bit subversive. They're a little bit underground. And they're all signified with the Web 2.0 star there. So the first principle, the most fundamental principle, if interaction isn't provided, create it. Imagine this lecture here, right? Imagine we didn't have the Ustream going or anything like that. You're all there in the audience. There isn't really any interaction because the person at the front of the room just won't stop talking, right? So this is an opportunity for you to create the interactivity yourself. Take this into your own hands and create the interactivity. To start sending SMSs back and forth, to Twitter the lecture. When I'm in a situation like this, I'd be at the back of the room because I never have changed from my university days. I'd be at the back of the room. I'd be typing away, blogging it, because that's how I interact with lectures. I sit down and I blog it. And I find that blogging it helps me remember what was talked about, but it also helps me evaluate. And then, of course, I'm connecting with many other people who weren't present at the event. If there is no official discussion of a subject, and there are many subjects around which there are no official discussions, because the people in power or officialdom just don't want to talk about it, if there's no official discussion, create one. We've had copyright issues in Canada, and our government is being pressured by a certain large neighboring country, which I will not name, to have new copyright legislation. And we've had to create our own discussion network in Canada to talk about this, because there haven't really been official channels of discussion. And there are no official discussions about how to resist this large neighboring country, which I will not mention. This is what you have to do. Organize yourself. Set up your own discussions. If something is important to you and you want to talk about it, set up your own discussion and don't wait for the official channel. Set up a Ning, a Wiki, a Google document. Ning used to be free. Now it'll cost you like almost $3 a month for the simple version. Wikis are free. Google documents are free. And there's all kinds of things you can do to set up these yourself. Use back channels. Back channels originate way before the internet. And people think all these things happened at the beginning of the internet, but back channels existed well before the internet. And the idea is to leverage the communication that already exists between person to person in an audience or in a group. Back channels can be created using private lists, like on Yahoo groups or Gmail accounts that are shared, perhaps. Using Flickr tags or Twitter tags these days as well, or as they call them, hashtags. In English, the symbol here is sometimes called a hash, as well as a pound sign. You probably knew that, didn't you? Anyhow. So now I move to the second of the principles, which is usability. And there are two major elements of usability in my mind. Of course, there could be more. But these are the things that strike me as particularly important. Consistency, knowing what to expect, the same thing day after day after day, very important. And simplicity, being able to understand how something works, not having to go through a long and complex process in order to do something. These are things that you want to introduce into your life, not just in information management or learning, but I think into your life in general. Consistency and I forgot the other one already. Let's go back. And simplicity are things that are very hard to get in our lives and things that we actually have to strive to make happen in our lives. So, let's think about this. Let's think about it from the perspective of a learner to begin with. And although it's true that the content and the structure of learning is usually determined by somebody else. If you take charge of your own learning, then you are able to create a sense of consistency in your learning. I'll give you a bit of an example. I'm not sure how well this will relate, but it might. When I went to university, as Alejandro mentioned, I took courses in many different disciplines, in the sciences, in the humanities. I didn't take any art, but I could have, in philosophy and religion. And every one of these courses, they all had their own theories. They all had their own terminology. And then after I graduated, I came into the field of education, and I saw all my familiar theories from science and philosophy, but in education, they all had their own new names and new people that you had to quote. And I thought, this is ridiculous. By going from one discipline to another discipline to another discipline, I had to learn entire vocabularies, entire sets of principles and jargon and names of people. So I decided, forget this. There are no disciplines. It's all one discipline, and I will determine how to structure it. And that's what I mean by taking charge of your learning. Instead of having these structures imposed on you, shape them for yourself. It's not that hard to do. The first thing you want to do is clarify what you think are first principles. Now, you know, it doesn't mean that you're going to have, you know, the ultimate foundations of knowledge, or, you know, the five essential ways to do your job or anything like that. You use that as a starting point. You use that as a way to structure your other discussion. They are what Wittgenstein called riverbed propositions. They can shift and change with time as your course changes. It's okay. But you use them as something that you can hang your other thinking on. Me, I structure my thinking around the idea of networks, distributed thinking, diversity, harmony, freedom, and democracy. Yeah, that's kind of a loosey-goosey sort of way of structuring it. But I look at other things in light of these underlying principles. So what you want to do is identify for yourself what elements of life and what elements of work are most important, and then think of those as the underlying elements against which everything else will be structured. I probably could have explained that more clearly, but I think you get the idea. Then, once you've done that, start to organize your knowledge. The way you can organize your knowledge, there are all kinds of tools, online tools, you can use to organize your knowledge. And the idea here is that you just set up, well, I've said, you know, build your own CMS using Drupal or Joomla. You don't even need to do that anymore. You can go to Google Documents, Google Tools, or Zoho. If you don't want to use Google, you may not have seen Zoho. Zoho is wonderful. One day it's going to be bought by someone. But it's all the stuff that Google does, but it's not Google. So I really like it. So let me give you an example, because I was just thinking of it this afternoon. And it's something I'm going to do. I'll be back into Twitter. So let's get ourselves back into our presentation here. Now, I don't speak Spanish. You probably know this. But, you know, I've learned English in the past, and I've studied French, and I speak French passably well. So if I were to learn Spanish, it would be my third language. And I've learned a thing or two about learning languages in that time. And since I've been here in Argentina, especially, my Spanish has been really improving, which is great. But now, you know, there are different ways I could go about learning Spanish, but the thing for me to do is to try to structure it in my own mind. I have the little Spanish phrase book, and I have the Spanish dictionary and all that, and these are really useful to me, but, you know, I structure things my own way. So, first of all, I want my verbs, because I need verbs, because otherwise I wouldn't have any actions. So, you know, so and I just have, you know, like, each verb would have its own line, and then the tenses, the present, and the past. It'd be kind of a longish grid, right? And then I'd have them all on one page, right? So, like, you know, well, not all, because there's a lot of verbs, but yet, you know, the 25 most important. And it'd be right there. And then I'd take it, print it out, use the thumbtack, and I'm actually going to do this. I did this with French, and it worked really well. Stick it on the wall in my bathroom. That's what you call taking charge of your own learning. And then another thing that I applied in French, which really worked well for me, because it was really hard until then, was the noun builder. And, you know, you have a noun, right? And, you know, anything can be, you know, an apple, brick, chair, whatever. But then you have all kinds of things you can use to modify that noun. Adjectives, etc. So, you know, there's number, quantity, there's possession. What was the other one? There's a third one. Number, quantity, possession. That goes before the noun. See, this is my need. Anyhow, but the idea is, right, is you can have a column for each one of these, because like if you're talking about, say, a cup, you can talk about my one light white cup that I borrowed from the owners here, right? You see how I can modify the noun? So what I did when I was learning French is I created a noun builder, which was the sequence of the different modifiers, one then the other. So you have quantity and ownership and then the noun itself and then what it's made of and what color it is, because color comes after in French, etc. Then all the different possibilities. So quantity, right? In Spanish, uno, unus, or whatever, right? Unos? I'm not very good at this yet. But I'm still learning, right? And then, so, you know, and then the next column, the ownership, me, su, tu, and et cetera. You know, the colors that it could be, so I don't even know, like rosa, and what is blue? Blue? Azul. Azul. Right, okay, right. Which I remember as azure. But yeah. See, because, and that's what's confusing, right? Because azure is the word azure in English, which is blue, but it's not blue, anyhow. But you get the idea, right? And it doesn't matter how you do it. The idea is you take what's important to you and you start slicing and dicing and organizing it for yourself and make it consistent. Because if I get this to work, the next language, which will be, I don't know, Portuguese, that would make sense, will be really easy because I have all of my structures and it's really consistent now. And I've also taught myself grammar while I've been at it. So if you structure your understanding, you are able to take control of the material rather than material controlling you. Then simplify it. Don't just let people determine the vocabulary to use, right? Use your own language. Use your own way of representing things, your own way of thinking of things. You know, it's a horrible way to do it. I had to get a new lens cap when I was in Rosario. Well, lens cap is not in my Spanish dictionary. So cap translated as sombrero. Okay. That's as good as I got. And lens, objetivo. So I asked por un sombrero por mi objetivo. But it worked. The person was able to say, no, I don't have one. But it's interesting because objetivo, right? Well, in English, there's the objective lens. It's the name of a type of lens. So that's how I can remember, maybe mispronouncing it, but objetivo, I can remember it because of that association with lenses. It's me connecting this knowledge to my own terminology, my own vocabulary. And I find I do that a lot, especially in learning languages, but in learning generally. So, anyhow. Now, I'm probably the last person to be talking to you guys about language learning, but these are my experiences. And I think the principles, certainly from my experience, the principles apply not just in language learning, or not just in my language learning, but in other principles, other areas as well. Certainly in things like philosophy and education. I've had to do this in philosophy and education. The philosophers have this set of terms, the educators have this set of terms, they actually map nicely and neatly one-to-one. Sometimes it's even the same guy, like Dewey or Seymour Papert is a good one. Very well-known in philosophy, very well-known in education. Completely different vocabularies. You'd never know it was the same person, but it is, and it's the same theory. It maps one-to-one. So, something very interesting. But you don't know that until you structure the information your own way. That's what's key. And so we get to the other point that I mentioned earlier in the talk, not compartmentalizing, not allowing the disciplines to shape us, but rather us to shape the discipline. there's a great chart, a diagram, and I was looking for it. I wasn't able to find it today. But it's a network diagram of all the different disciplines and how they're connected. And, you know, it's easy to say art is distinct from biology, is distinct from history. But when you look at the references, the actual references from one set of journal articles to the other set of journal articles, they are all related. They are all part of the same domain of inquiry. They're all horribly inconsistent, but that's just the nature of inquiry. But they're all part of the same picture. So it's arbitrary to separate them. So I separate things my own way. I don't worry about how they are separated by the rest of the world. Because it's my knowledge. So, how do you do this practically? How do you do this in your own work, in your own environment? If your employer has a content management system, it almost certainly will not work for you because they will have imposed their own structure. Remember, well, maybe you don't, maybe I date myself, but when Yahoo first came out, you know Yahoo, right? Nobody goes there anymore, right? Everybody goes to Yahoo. They decided to create a directory of the entire web, which was a good idea. But what they did is they categorized every web page. And so they hired a whole large number of indexers, and they had these long, ridiculous categorizations, you know, world, continents, people, nations, South America, Peru, Incan, customs, traditions, artifacts of. That was one category. And so if you wanted to find anything in Yahoo, you had to think like their indexers. And since their indexers are, I don't know, 60-year-old from Los Angeles, nobody thinks like them. So people didn't use that system. They couldn't use that system. You had to use a search much along the model of a Google rather than a categorization. There is no single categorization of the world. Never will be. And if you try to follow somebody else's categorization, like your employer's, you'll probably run into difficulty. So instead, create a blog on Blogger or somewhere else, doesn't matter where, just to keep notes. It's really useful and you can always use Google to search it. Or another thing you can do is keep your notes on your USB. Everything I've ever written, every presentation I've ever made is on this. This gives me so much security. And I have a backup in case I lose it. And if a thief takes it, great. I hope he reads it. and USBs aren't that expensive anymore. Store your photos on Flickr. And because it's not just that you have an image library, and it's not like you're just taking party pictures and posting them. Take pictures of everything, anytime. I took a picture of that. I don't know what it is, but I took a picture of it. I took a picture of the plants outside because they were pretty interesting. I took a picture of the cafeteria. I took a picture of you. Why? Because not simply to have a record of the event, although that's pretty cool, but to have pictures of cafeterias, plant, teacher? I guess it's a teacher, is it?
It's a saint.
Okay, so now I have a stock image of a saint. And if I need to put a stock image of a saint into one of my presentations sometime in the future, I don't need to go to Bill Gates and ask for permission to use an image. I just use my Flickr image. Taking control of my resources, right? And I use Flickr because I can share my image and I license it with Creative Commons, which allows anybody else to use the image. And then I use other people's Creative Commons images. And there are, I don't know what the number is, it's about 40 or 50 million images, very good images on Flickr that people can share. So, great. We've created our own image library. It's bigger and better than a commercial image library, and we can add to it anytime we want. Perfect. It's taking control of your own information. Here's something. Create a Gmail account, forward important emails to yourself. And you might think, why would I do that? Well, you're working, say, at an institution. The email exchange goes furiously back and forth. You get into a fight with your boss. You're fired. They cut off your email. Where's your evidence? You've lost it, right? Your email has been cut off. You no longer can access your correspondence with your boss. You can't prove you've been fired unjustly. But if you forward email to Gmail, now you have a backup record of everything. It costs you nothing, and it took you about 2 seconds to do. You know, taking control of your own information. That's what this is about, isn't it? Finally, relevance. This is about getting the information, the knowledge, the learning, the resources that you want, that you need, where you want. It's getting the right content, but equally important, it's getting it at the right time and in the right place. Because the right content's always out there, right? You probably learned the right content sometime back in the first year of university. Problem is, you didn't need it then, you need it now, and you've forgotten it. And if you're like me, you've forgotten it. So the idea is to get the content now when you need it. So you need to set up your information sources so that this is happening. So I have a 3-step process. This doesn't have to be 3 steps. Again, anytime I categorize things or sort things out or talk about principles, these are just expressions that I'm using. They're not the way the world is. They're just the way I organize things, because that's what I do. I organize my own content. Also makes my presentations a lot easier to put together. First principle, or first step, maximize your sources. Access more information than you need. Way more information than you need. I find right now RSS is the best way to go. How many of you know what RSS is? Anyone? Nobody? Oh, my. Oh, you're going to love this. Oh, you are going to love this. Okay, you all have internet, right? You all read blogs and things like that. They're a pain to keep up with, right? You can't really follow very many. And you always have to go back. You go back, you check somebody's blog. They haven't added a thing. So you just wasted like 2 minutes while it loaded. RSS solves all of that for you. This isn't part of the talk, but since you don't know what it is. All right. If you go from, you know, go to various pages that are out there on the internet, you'll see this little symbol here. Sometimes it's up in the top address window. And usually it's orange, not blue. Sometimes it's blue. I don't know why. Sometimes it's orange. If you look on my homepage, things are going a bit more slowly because we're streaming. Stopped. Don't say stopped. Did I say I want you to stop? This might be a bit tricky, but so I'll just get this going in the background while we're waiting. Okay. La-dee-da-dee-da. Oh, now this has bogged right down, hasn't it? Here we go. Oh, it's going to be blue too. Okay. You see this little symbol. And sometimes you see it on the page. This indicates what's called an RSS feed. And I'm just going to pop one open here. This is the RSS feed for my website. It's like a secret web page behind the web page. All right. So there it is. So it's just the content on my site, and all of the RSS pages look somewhat like this. It's like the secret web. Well, it's not really a secret, but you know what I mean. You press, you click on that little symbol anytime you see it, and you'll get one of these pages. What this actually looks like is that. And you're going, oh my God, what a mess. That's okay. But what I want you to see is that this is a structured description of the page. So all you need to know to make this work, you don't need any of that. All you need to know is the content of the page is structured in a standard way. So how does that help you, you ask? Good question. Glad you asked. When you have RSS, you can subscribe to the RSS feed. What that means is you have an account in something like Google Reader. There are other RSS readers, but I use Google Reader. Okay? This is reader.google.com. So I'll open up my account, which is mysteriously in Spanish today. And so this is going to take a little bit to load. So here are the different ways I can subscribe to the feed. All right. But since I have a Google Reader account, I made that first, I have Google. So I'll go to reader.google.com, create an account, and then this will show up when you click on subscribe. And then all you need to do now is select Google, subscribe now, add to Google Reader, and you're subscribed to the feed. Now, what does that mean? Look at my Google Reader. These are the feeds that I subscribe to. Each one of these is a different blog, a different website from a different writer. This is a lot of information. So here's George Simmons. You know George Simmons, right? Here's how I keep up with George Simmons. I don't go to his webpage. I have an entry forum here. I have about 900 or so feeds that I follow. His is one of them. And so I can read whatever George has to write. So the importance of ELG in the future of learning. Yeah. Immersive learning. Yeah. Critical literacies. Yeah. Networked Harvard Magazine. So I can read his writing. If I want to remember it for later, I'll just star it. So that's the stuff that I want to keep for later. And what I do is I just skim through the articles in Google Reader. I star the things that look like they're going to be important to me. And then I can go back later. Here are my starred items. So here's the item from George that I just starred. All right, here's an essay by Tony Bates, who is very good, also Canadian, by the way. Have you invited Tony to Argentina? Tony Bates?
I don't know if
you have that. Yeah. He's been just about everywhere else. Okay, here's something. And so on. I could go on about RSS, but you get the idea, right? What I've done is all of the different sources that I have to read content, I've subscribed to their RSS feeds, and now they're all available in the same place. And it's a really easy interface to use. I can cover a lot of content. And if I don't want to read all of the content, no problem. I'll just mark it as read. And I don't worry about it. If it's important, it'll surface again. And I treat this content, 1,000 feeds, there's probably about right now, because I've been a bit slow, maybe 10,000 different items. I don't think, oh my God, I have to read 10,000 different items. I think, I've got 10,000 items I can pick from today. Yeah, it's good. And then I read the ones that are interesting to me. I skip the ones that aren't. And if I don't have time even to look at the title, that's okay. It's all right. I just sample what I can sample. So, yeah, get yourself an RSS account. Totally. This will change your lives. Forget the whole rest of this entire talk. This will change your lives. This is huge. Wow, yeah, because once you have RSS feeds, how many of you follow people on Twitter? No? Okay, well, if you were following people on Twitter, you could follow them using RSS. How many people use Google to search for things? Okay. Problem with using Google to search is you have to go back every time, right? All right. So create an RSS feed of a Google search, and whenever there's something new in that search, it'll show up in your RSS feed. How's that sound? So that's really easy to do. That's how I keep tracking it. It just figures I would keep track of that. This is how I keep track of what people have to say about me. And so here we go. I'll scroll down here a bit. I've organized them into categories because it's a bit easier that way. So ideas, me and mine. Downs, Google blog search. And this will take a few seconds because there's 47 items. Here we go. This is stuff that has been written about me or about other people named Downs. So a lot of this stuff isn't very useful to me. Some guy named John Downs is ringmaster of CFZ Circus. Well, that's worth knowing. Mm-hmm. Molly Panter Downs. John Downs is really spamming the list today. I don't know who he is. There's a guy called Stephen Downs who writes for the Honolulu Advertiser. I have found every Stephen Downs in the world doing this. But this is a Google search. It just shows up in here. And when there's a new resource that matches the search, it shows up. So I use this. Of course I use this. I have searches set up for different kinds of learning. For those of you who don't know, I have a newsletter that I produce every day. And here's the RSS feed for it, right? But I use RSS, and I use these feeds from Google and various blogs and newspapers and magazines and educational institutions. And to do my newsletter, all I need to do is sit down, look at the results from my RSS feeds, pick the things that are important, write a little bit about them, and I'm done. It's so easy to manage information that way because I'm treating it not as content to be memorized. I do not treat it as content to be memorized. Very important because you can't. 1,000 feeds, 10,000 items, I couldn't memorize the content from one day, much less a lifetime, right? It's not intended to be memorized. Rather, you dip into it like it's a river. And when you need to find out what's happening, you just check it. You just look at it. Watch the world go by. And sorry about that. I moved right out of your field. So, yeah. RSS. RSS readers. Look it up. Ignore everything else in my talk. But, you know, me being me, I'm going to give the talk anyways, because this is only step one. Rats. I have to do it this way. Step two. Once you have your 1,000 information sources, or even if you have like 25, it doesn't really matter, filter. Filter ruthlessly. There is so much information in the world today, you can't even store it, let alone remember it. You do not have a big enough hard drive. I showed you this already. This is 16 gigabytes. I have a 1.5 terabyte hard drive at home. If I tried to store the stuff that I collect, I would fill those. In a day, it might take a whole week to fill them. You can't store everything. It's not possible. So store very little. Don't store anything unless you know you're going to need it. If you don't know you're going to need it, delete it. And this applies to everything. Emails, blog posts, anything. If you don't know you're going to need it, delete it. Now you might think, this is a dangerous thing to do. It's not that dangerous a thing to do. If it's important, it'll surface again, right? Also, a lot of systems have backups so that you can undelete. And you can search these backups, especially institutional email. If you use Microsoft Outlook in your institution or something like that, if your institution is like mine, every day your institution is backing up your email. It's ridiculous, but that's how they set it up. So they're doing all the backing up. If you don't really need it, delete it. And bad things probably won't happen to you. Or do it this way. Fire it off to Google Mail and forget about it. All right? Get it out of your way. You know, and when I talk about filtering, you know, a lot of people think of knowledge as just data that you filter and that the rest, whatever results from that is knowledge. You know, when I say filter, I actually mean something much broader. I filter, evaluate, question, be skeptical, combine, reword, rework, all of these things that I've been talking about, right? And that leads us to the third step. Convert the information that you find. This is the origin of my newsletter. You saw my newsletter that I just showed you a few seconds ago. This is how it began. I was just simply collecting a list of resources. I was using Netscape. That was a web browser at the time. And it's kind of like Firefox, only slower, more primitive. Anyhow, I was storing information in bookmarks. And, you know, after a few thousand bookmarks, it gets a little hard to handle. They were impossible to search, impossible to do anything with. I figured out how to convert them to a web page, but then I just had a big, ugly web page. So eventually, I learned how to create a content management system, and then I would just feed them into the content management system. But what I did, which proved to be really important, is I didn't just copy and paste them. Because, you know, if you copy and paste something, you lose it in your mind, right? None of it stays in your mind. It's a purely mechanical action. But what I did is I'd take the basic information, like the title, the author, the link, but I'd write my own summary. I would interpret the content of that resource in my own words. And I'd offer my own commentary. Whether I liked the resource, whether I thought it was relevant, whether I thought there was an error in the reasoning. All of these sorts of things. You know. And this became my knowledge base. And gradually I amassed a collection of them. Right now I have about 17,000 of them. I've written a personalized comment for each and every one of them. That's so much easier to search, because all of the commentary is mine, all of the terminology is my terminology, the issues that I raise in my own thinking, these are what's reflected in these commentaries. By converting them, by writing them in my own words, I've made them that much more useful. Also, I remember them better. You know, it's like the principle of taking notes in a classroom. I notice many of you take notes. It's generally accepted practice in a classroom. Do you go back and read the notes later? All of them? Probably not. Some of you do. There's always someone. Always there's someone, right? But a lot of the notes, over time, you'll find that you don't read. But the act of taking the note was important because you're interacting with the content as it comes into your mind. So you're doing something with it. You're manipulating it. You're creating something with it. And that helps you remember it. And even if you don't remember the exact content, it's formed part of your overall mental picture of the world. What's important in this process is that you set this up for yourself. You organize your information your own way. You organize your sources, your RSS feeds. Every single, I don't know if this is true, but it's probably close to true. Every single person in the world, give or take, has their own list of RSS feeds. There may be some duplicates, but if there are, they're accidental. Each person can have their own individual list of sources. And if you look at the list of sources that people have, they are, in fact, all different. This is really important. It's a really important observation to make about how people have actually organized their learning. Each person has his or her own set of sources that is not the same as everyone else's. There's some overlap. A certain number of people subscribe to my feed, for example, but a lot of people don't. I've learned to live with that. Certain other number of people subscribe to George Siemens. A lot of people who subscribe to me subscribe to George, but some people subscribe to him and not me. Some people subscribe to me and not him, and it's all okay. That's the way it should be, because each person has their own set of sources, which means when they have a conversation, they have something interesting to talk about. So, how do you get your information sources the way you want? Mostly, not completely, but mostly, you will probably not want to go to formal classes and take formal lessons. You'll probably want to do informal activities. Now, informal, by informal, I don't mean less intensive. I don't mean shorter. Often they can take longer. They can often be more intensive. They're often immersive activities that completely occupy your time. But they're not formally structured like classes. They're not offered by formal institutions like colleges or universities. And again, it's like language learning, which is something that you can relate to, and I suffer through. No, I'm just kidding. You can take formal classes, but that'll take you only so far, right? And it'll take you a certain amount of time. But to learn a language, really the way to learn it is to immerse yourself in a community that speaks the language and to practice speaking that language, right? I'm asking you. That's what I believe, but you guys are the ones who are more expert at it than I am. Certainly that's been my experience, and it's been my experience generally. Journalism, I spent many years working in journalism. I'm actually a combination of a bunch of things. There's philosophy, computers, education, and media. But again, you can take journalist classes, and I'll take you so far, but really you have to work on a newspaper. A TV station or radio station. If you're not actually doing journalism, there's an important element of journalism that you don't experience, that you don't understand. Do connect online to your RSS feeds from your home, even on vacation. I do it because I miss it if I don't. And I feel better. I just feel connected. That doesn't mean I never take a break. I took a break. I went for 2 weeks to the Canary Islands and just disappeared. People were very concerned. And they write me, "Where's my newsletter?" But the point here that I want to make is that your learning, your information processing doesn't necessarily happen to a set schedule. My best work comes either at midday, around noon, lunchtime. I do a lot of my stuff at lunch, or in the middle of the night is when I do a lot of stuff. Interestingly, when I travel, I'm more productive than when I'm at home in my office working, where I'm very unproductive. There's so many things I can do to waste time in my office, you wouldn't believe. So the ideas happen when they happen. And, people talk about finding a life-work balance. And it used to be, you separate your life from your work. And I think it's more like you make sure you have that balance, but if your work intrudes into your life, you should see it as fair for your life to intrude into your work. Keep the balance, right? And if they're saying, well, if your employers are saying, look, you must do no internet surfing on the job, then your response should be, well, I'll do no work when I'm at home then, and see how they like that. Mm-hmm. And generally you can reach an arrangement. Relevance. I talk to people, again, talking about media, I ask people where they get their news from, and they usually say the newspaper or television or radio, and my response is, well, why do you want to spend your time reading all those lies? And I exaggerate a bit to make the point, but the point is that there are many, many sources of news beyond newspaper, radio, and television. They come from different points of view, they cover different things, and you can get a much better understanding of the news or any other subject if you disregard or at least minimize your reading or use of official channels and start following the unofficial channels. I live in a small town called Moncton, very small city, 150,000 people. Can you imagine that? There's blocks in this city that are bigger than that. We have one newspaper, and it's a horrible, horrible newspaper. And there was a company, an e-learning game company in Moncton, that's the name of the city, launched a brand new game. There was a film production that had its premiere, its opening show downtown. None of this was covered in our newspaper. I know. No, they were going on about maybe they should tear down the school because it costs too much to renovate, and what was the other big issue of the day? Oh, there was some other... The newspaper has a very narrow focus on politics and Paris Hilton. That's it. So, but there's much more to the world than that. None of what I do, none, is covered in traditional media. Except maybe they did an interview in Rosario, I'm not sure. But, this whole field is not covered in traditional media. Yet, unarguably, it exists. And there is news about it, but you have to find out about it from alternative channels. And this is what is happening generally. The official channels can cover news that applies only to massive numbers of people, millions of people. But, there were many areas of our society of interest only to hundreds of thousands of people. These will not be covered in traditional news. But they will be covered in blogs, newsletters, and so on. All these things that you can get in your RSS reader. Lots of things you can do to organize and make sure your content is where you want it. Set up, organize your content, create a wiki, create project pages for the different projects that you have. Track wiki. If you're doing any sort of software development project, is a great way of organizing your development. There are other wikis for other purposes. Different technology that you can use to connect to colleagues. I asked how many of you use Twitter. None of you seemed to use Twitter. There's a few at the front.
It just started. It started with, I think, was quite famous as Obama.
Obama. Twitter is interesting. Twitter, it's just twitter.com, twitter.com. And if you set up an account on it, it'll seem really stupid. It'll seem so stupid. Basically, it's a little box, and you can type a message into that box no longer than 140 characters. It's got to be very short. And when you hit send or submit, it'll be sent to whoever is subscribing to you. Which one you start is nobody. But, it's sort of pointless at the very beginning. But, what happens is you tell people what your Twitter address is. Like, my Twitter address is Downes, D-O-W-N-E-S. Very simple. These days it's a little more complicated because there's lots of people on it. But, you can subscribe to other people's Twitter accounts, and they can subscribe to you. And if you subscribe to them, then when they type their little message, you'll read it. There's many ways to read Twitter messages. And TweetDeck and Tweety are two examples of ways to use...
Question from...
Oh. Even with RSS and Twitter, there is an overload of information to process. How do you cope? How much time does it take you? Tips. Okay. Well, let me begin this five-hour lecture then. No, I'm just kidding. It's a river, not a reservoir. All right? You let it go by. You don't try to keep it. Because like a river, when you go back the next day, there will be more water. You know, there's not going to be a shortage. In fact, if you try to keep it, there will be too much. So, you know, it's like Buddhism on steroids. Like, if you try to cling to this stuff, you will suffer. So don't try to cling to it. That's the first lesson. If you haven't been able to keep up, let it go. There will always be more. It's like my newsletter. My newsletter comes out every day. Even if you haven't read it, it still comes out every day. Every day you go to my website, there'll be a new issue. So if you missed the old ones, let them go. If you really need the content, Google search will find it for you. If you need the content without all the extra stuff, you can do a search simply on my feed or simply of your RSS feeds. So that's the first rule. Let it go. The second rule, and there's only two rules. It's really easy. The second rule is based on a principle of neuroscience. Again, a principle of the way the mind works. And I'll have to make a little bit of a detour to get there, but that's okay. This applies to some of the second part of the talk anyways. So how do I want to do this? The little detour. When I'm asked to define knowledge, and I'm asked to define knowledge a surprisingly large number of times, which is a bit frightening to me, I say knowledge is like finding Waldo. And people go, great, he's turned into a Chinese. I asked in Rosario, they said, you call it Wally here. Where's Wally? Yeah. So you know what it is, right? So it's the big picture. There's like a billion people on the picture. One of them is Wally, or in Canada it's Waldo. Does he have the big red and white hat? Yeah. Okay. And the idea is you look at the picture, and you look all through the picture, you try to find Wally, right? And then, eventually, you find him. After you find him, you can't unfind him. Right? The next time you look at that picture, oh yeah, there he is. Okay. That's knowledge. And you might think, okay, well, that's really stupid. No, it isn't. Okay. Knowledge is pattern recognition. Knowledge is seeing the patterns that exist in, well, it depends on your perspective, but that exist in your perceptual field, that exist in the world, that exist in society or whatever. Knowledge is recognizing those patterns. To know something is to recognize something, just like knowing where Wally is. So how do you know that you know something? Because you can't not know it. Try not knowing that there's a floor here. Right? It's the sort of thing you can kind of do it conceptually, theoretically maybe, but really you can't, right? Try to imagine that you don't exist. Well, yeah, okay, theoretically. You know, I mean, we're all aware of our own impending demise. But from a practical point of view, you know, doing what I'm going to do tomorrow, can I do it without existing? Well, no. Right? So knowing is recognizing these patterns and recognizing them so well, you can't imagine them not existing. Or even if you can, you just for practical purposes, you can't. Can you imagine not being able to find Wally? Sure. I mentioned in Rosario, my dentist, I'm sure you've all had experiences with dentists, right? They sit you in the chair, you're looking up at the ceiling. My dentist put, "Where's Waldo?" on the ceiling. That was interesting the first time. He doesn't change it. So I go to the dentist, and so same picture, okay, well, I'll just imagine I can't find him. No, there he is. Right? That's knowing. That's, and so, why is that relevant? Well, now, you have this stream, this river of stuff coming by. How do you deal with it? You recognize things that are important. It's like a forest and you recognize the tiger. Why do you recognize the tiger? Well, some experiences in your past have made it important to you, right? So you have this stream, this river, you recognize a log. Why do you recognize a log? Well, it stands out. There's a fish jumping. Why do you see the fish? Fish are important. You can eat them. They can eat you. you see what I mean? That's how you do it. That's what I do. And that's how anybody who works with a large volume of information works. It's recognition. You just see what's important. This is generally true. This is not just true of RSS feeds. Think about driving. Many of you drive, maybe all of you drive. You're driving down the road. I've been on those roads. it's chaos. You know, cars going, signs, birds, signs, a little bit of garbage, people, somebody running across it. How do you recognize when to turn the steering wheel? Well, that's just it. You recognize, all right? You don't see every single thing in the picture in front of you. You couldn't. You couldn't possibly. You pick out and recognize what's important based on your previous experience. And this previous experience is based on your experience as a driver. This is not something you're taught at driver school. In fact, they can't do it. They physically cannot teach you this in driver school. They can sit there and instruct you all day, and yet you actually have to have practice as a driver to begin to recognize things. This is true if you're a physicist, an astrophysicist. You know how they discover planets that are outside the solar system? They sit there and they look at star maps, photographs that they've taken of the stars, and they recognize what doesn't belong. Well, how do you think doctors solve symptoms? Does a doctor look at every single feature of you? You go into the doctor, they start at the top, okay, I'm going to look at this hair, and then this hair, and then this. No, they look at you as a whole, and they recognize symptoms. I could go on, but you get the idea. Dealing with any large body of data, which is pretty much any discipline, any field, anything more complicated than, you know, basic mathematics, or printing, is based on a principle of recognition of patterns in the environment. This is the underlying principle to connectivist knowledge. I've written about it in various places, and I've written about it. Lots of people have written about it over the years, but this is the underlying principle. How do you clarify this information? What patterns do you take into account? Everybody does it differently, right? That's why I'm saying you do it your own way. You have to do it your own way. Why? Because your perceptions, your experiences, your capacity to recognize is individual to you. There are no principles, right? There are things that other people do which are patterns that you can detect as well. But there are, you know, there's no principle I can say. You know, Immanuel Kant tried to do this. He tried to organize this. So, okay, well, we'll go through the transcendental deduction, deduce, 100 pages later, still deducing, and come up with two basic categories, space and time. Good work, Kant. And then work from there. But really, even space and time are questionable. Einstein comes along and says they're the same thing. And anything beyond that really is a matter of personal experience, personal preference. You categorize, clarify, organize this information in whatever way works for you. And now I feel like John Dewey saying that. The philosophical John Dewey, not the educator John Dewey, although it's the same guy. Relevance. Yeah, I'm just going to do a few slides here. I have a whole part too, but I'm not doing it.
And show them your slideshare so they can.
Oh, yeah, I'll certainly. That's a good point. Yeah, it's another place with RSS feed. So you'll be able to see the rest. And the second part is actually written out a lot. Anyway, I hope this has been useful. You haven't forgotten about the RSS.
Can I say something?
Yes.
I think that the whole thing, as you were saying at the beginning, it's a question of how relevant that information is
to
each individual. It's not only identifying the patterns, but also, you know, seeing what's important for us in those patterns.
Absolutely.
I have an account of everything, you know, Facebook, Twitter, and honestly, the ones that are relevant to me, I mean, I stopped using Twitter because it's no use for me.
Sure.
So I think it's a question of identifying what's relevant for each individual.
That's so cute.
And that's the way to go about it.
Yeah. I've learned to live with the fact that my phone is usually turned off and I hardly ever use SMS. And people say, well, you must. Well, no. I went through my entire university career without a phone. No phone. And it was okay. I got my first telephone when I got my first job teaching philosophy over the telephone. That's when I got a phone. And then once I finished that, I gave up my phone again. And I didn't get one again until I got married and my wife got a phone. And so now I have a phone in the house because she has one. And then this one came with, well, it's a status symbol, so I demanded it. But I don't use it. But anyhow, you're absolutely right. It depends on personal preferences because everybody organizes information differently. Everybody recognizes patterns differently, which means everybody's tools are slightly different.
And I say something about excellent observation, no? And maybe sometimes it's important to unplug yourself, to have your own personal experience on the things that you have learned. I don't know if I agree myself. I mean, one is plugged all the time. And I think that certain unpluggings in some moments, it gives you time to know if that's your real idea, if that's your own perception. Sometimes you have so much information, even if it's very clear, and you have it there, and you're building. Sometimes you need that to see something more.
I think that in my own case, and I think as you know, again, I don't want to say a general principle because I'm sure there's someone out there this doesn't apply to, but diversity is very important. Diversity of experience, diversity of sources of ideas, diversity of media, of types of information that you're getting. Even when I came here to Argentina, I've been visiting people and giving talks and things like that, but the day before yesterday, I spent the day walking through Rosario. I was not online. I was not communicating with anyone. I was just walking through Rosario. I spent, I don't know, 5 or 6 hours walking through Rosario because it's a different kind of experience. It's a very concrete experience. It's a very physical experience, tactile. You know, I'm right there in the city understanding what the city is like. And I saw all kinds of things I would never see experienced, either giving talks at schools or online or anything like that. So I agree with you that having a diversity of experience is very important. But again, it's going to depend on different people what that diversity is. I go to the forest a lot. I can because I live in Canada, but even when I visit other places, I like to go out into the wilderness and into the forest. For some people, that's important. For me, it's important. For other people, it's less important, and so even here, you know, is going to many different bars and discos part of the diversity. For me, it used to be, but then I go old. Now it's not so much anymore because I can't stay up that late. You know what I mean? So even within all of this diversity, people have their own individual patterns. I'm going to do three or four more slides. I'm going to say that there are more slides that you can see in SlideShare. I'll show you what SlideShare is, but then we'll go to discussion and commentary and etc. Because I want to summarize this bit that I've been doing, the three major aspects of personal learning. And the first major aspect, I come back to this over and over and over again. You, as an individual, doesn't mean you're all alone, but you are at the center of your own personal learning network. You have your own set of friends out there in the world that nobody else has. You have your own set of books that you have read, and nobody else has read exactly the same books. Your own sources of information, your own ways of understanding this, and all of these are ways in which you relate to the rest of the world. And, you know, everybody does this, and we're all interconnected in this way, but each of us is connected in our own unique way. Very important. Because of that, in order to gain from self-directed learning, in order to gain from the opportunity that the internet offers you, you have to be self-directed. You can't let other people define this for you. If you do, they will define it according to what they understand. This applies even to this talk, right? If what I'm saying doesn't apply to you, reject it. I urge you to reject it, because you will find a better answer in some other way. And that's fine. That's okay. I don't mind that at all. My feelings won't be hurt. Even if they were, you should still find your own way. Because, again, each of you has a different set of experiences. We go back to neuroscience. Each of you has a neural network for your brain. It started out more or less the same as everyone else's because, you know, it's pretty much the same sort of genetic material. But experiences through life actually change the structure of your brain. New connections form between neurons, old connections break. And each of you now has a different brain. Not dramatically different, you know, not like rocks and roses, but you know, different enough. And the evidence of that is clear. If you look, you have to look sometimes. If you look around, none of you is dressed the same way. Even if you were dressed in the same way, you would not be sitting in the same posture. Your facial expressions are all different. Everyone is completely different from person to person. It's fabulous. And that's because your neural networks are different. You are experiencing this talk slightly differently from the person beside you. So you have to direct your learning. I can't do it. Your neighbor can't do it. Nobody else can do it. They can suggest, advise, poke, prod, cajole, but they cannot direct. Which leads to the third and final. These are also principles that tell us how to teach as well as to learn. Now, it's easy when we're a teacher to fall back into that old mold, right? I have my experiences, my way of seeing the world. That's what the students should learn. But the students are also individuals. And they're even less able to cope with this than you are. They need the capacity and the experience of directing their own learning, or they won't be able to do it when they're adults. So from the earliest age possible, they should be directing their own learning as much as possible so that they can get this experience, so that they can become efficient pattern recognizers. Now, like I said, I had the second part, but I took too long in the first part. But there's a bunch of slides which you can see if you look at SlideShare, and they consist of practical advice about how to set up what we would call a connectivist course, which would set up a learning experience based on the principles that I've just outlined that would help you as instructors enable the greatest possible self-directed learning experience for students. Now, just as an aside, and a practical aside, you will go out into the world, well, you're probably already out in the world, you work in institutions, you work in traditional schools, traditional classrooms. It is not possible to suddenly take all of this and apply it there. Your students aren't ready because they grew up having people direct their learning for them, so they're not good at recognizing patterns yet. Your institution most certainly isn't ready because they've spent all their lives telling people what to do, and they're not going to deal with this sudden freedom of learning. So you can't do the whole thing at once. You can't, in other words, impose this on other people. Not possible. All you can do, the only thing you can do, is to instantiate whatever parts of this you agree with in your own learning. It's like Gandhi said, you know, to be the change you want to see in the world. So if you think this is a good way to learn, then learn this way. And then, as you know, following the model of Alejandro and so many others, share. Let people see you learning this way. Let people see the advantage that you gain. You know, I showed you my Google Reader. I did that not because I wanted you to see a whole bunch of stuff, but because, you know, I get my newsletter, I get my advantage out of this information source. I want you to see it. Whether you do it is up to you. I can't do anything more than show you what I do, which is what this talk has been about. So I think that's of fundamental importance. Let me show you SlideShare. It'll take about a second. Maybe longer. Where did my... I see. Here are some slides. Notice that these slides are nicely embedded in my web page. This is a different talk that I gave. I was younger. Yeah, that's pretty funny. Here are some other talks that I gave. Here's the Symposium Rosario, etc. And, oh, I don't have the slides in this one up yet. We'll go back a wee bit more. I think this one's up. Yeah. Here are the slides from the talk that I gave in Cordoba. Pretty neat, eh? Slideshow embedded in a web page. And the way this works, and you can do this too, is you use a site called SlideShare. The URL is slideshare.net. It's going to take a little bit to load here, probably, because... And basically, all you do is, when you make some PowerPoint slides, you can save them as PowerPoint or as PDF, you upload them, and that way you can embed them in any web page that you want and share your slides without having to have people open up PowerPoint and all that. They just become embedded. There's slide shares. They're slides, just like a YouTube video, but slides. It's exactly the same principle. So, yeah, I like SlideShare. And this went up just the other day, and it's had 440 views already. And I have lots of slides up. And this will come up here. I have 171 different slideshows that I've done over the years, and they are all different. I try to do a different talk every time, which is why it sometimes doesn't come out perfectly like today. So anyhow, if you go to my website, which is my photos in Flickr, downs.ca. Pardon?
It's in the invitation.
Oh, good. Okay. If you go to that, then it'll be sometime, probably sometime tomorrow, maybe later today, but I understand we're going out for supper, so it'll probably be sometime tomorrow. The slides from this talk, as well as the audio recording, will be posted on my website for you to download or listen to or do whatever you want with. So any slides that I did not cover today, and there are some, you'll be able to read those and see what I didn't say. But that's okay. I understand I have another talk to do, so I think I know what that talk will be now. So any comments, discussion, questions, shouts of outrage, vicious recriminations? It's all okay.
You said something at the beginning of the talk. CMS and LMS,
yes,
in a way force you to, I mean, it's not something that should sort of happen in a virtual environment. What do you mean by that?
They, in a way, force you.
Is it this question that somebody else is choosing the content in a way and sort of directing you?
It's not
where
you need to be, or it's not simply that they're choosing the content, but also they're choosing the way the content is organized.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an important part of learning, I think, to organize your own content. But if your content comes already organized for you, like a package, that's an important element of working with the content that you're denying. You know, so I think that having your own web presence forces you to organize your content your own way. And then maybe later you can look at how other people have organized it, and then it becomes all very interesting. But to have it put upon you and said, this is the way the world is organized, you know, it takes away from your capacity to work with the content yourself. And it really is so important. I cannot stress how important that is. And yet, it forms such a small part of traditional education. Any other comments?
What is your feeling as regards teachers' preparation to use?
What is my feeling regarding teachers?
What is your experience? What
I see in teachers is mostly a lot of conservatism. And what I see in teachers is they're often scared and feel disempowered, and they shouldn't. And, you know, I know that there's a lot of outside pressures placed on teachers. And those outside pressures seem to define more than anything their experience of teaching. And I find that too bad. I find that unfortunate. And that's actually why I approached the subject in this way. Because I didn't want to be just another person who came in telling teachers how to teach. You know, there's I don't know, hundreds of speakers who come in and tell teachers how to teach. And what I really wanted was for teachers to have more confidence in their own ability and to have more ability to manage their learning and their information their own way, so that, you know, even if they should end up getting fired or something like that, at least they can depend on themselves to create a new position. You know, they can feel strong in their knowledge. And, you know, if they feel strong in their knowledge, then they feel strong in their job. They're able to resist some of these pressures and to be more proactive in their teaching. You know, I don't think that experts outside the field of teaching know about teaching. And I don't think that they do, because they don't have this experience. They don't have the capacity to recognize that I described in this talk. You know, I can stand here, because I've had experience teaching, and I can pretty much spot the people who agree with me and the people who think I'm kind of out there. Right. I can just spot them. Right. And you all can spot them. If any of you have had experience teaching, you know, right? And you know when somebody's got the point, and you know when somebody hasn't, because you recognize. And you learn to recognize not just people in general, but that individual in particular over time. And this is something, you know, teaching right now, the field of teaching, the discipline of teaching is being influenced a great deal by economists. I just don't get that. Because there isn't an economist in the world who's going to be able to stand there in a class and know the way a teacher will know in the first class who are the A students are going to be and who the F students are going to be. They reduce that to numbers and to, you know, generalizations based on formulas that cannot capture the cognitive capacity it takes to actually recognize achievement in a person. So I think, now, like I said, I see a lot of tentativeness, a lot of helplessness, and a lot of fear in teachers. And I hope for the day, and not just in any one place, everywhere I go. And it's something that I'd really like to see change, and for teachers to come into their own, and to be able to represent themselves and their discipline in a way that hasn't been represented by the economists or the politicians.
Oh, just a second. Can you go to your Twitter?
Twitter?
See, on the last Twitter, we have the Project of Facebook. It's on PDF complete already. It has been uploaded.
What has been uploaded?
The PDF of the Facebook project with your introduction in Spanish. So if you go to your Twitter, one of the last ones is here, mentions you. And then you have the URL.
See, I've been practicing my Spanish. Oh, yes! Use interest, no, I'm joking. I couldn't resist. Stephen, Stephen, at Downes, Downes, .ca. .ca, for Canada. Stephen at Downes, .ca.
I think you have to update it.
Because it won't be my Twitter account, right? So it's going to be something.
Okay.
But it should show up in the search.
There it is. If you click on that, I would say something in Spanish.
Oh, quickly. Right. Okay, I understand.
Okay. Muchas de las cosas de las que habló Stephen pasaron personalizada y él comentó al final que todos trabajamos en instituciones, ¿no? Entonces, bueno, colegios o escuelas y está planteando que se estudia de vehículos personalizados, de actividades personalizados, lo compagina con esta estandarización y estos formatos. Ocasionalmente se dan ciertas condiciones, yo diría, para institucionales, donde uno puede llevar esto a la práctica. Y uno de esos casos fue el que hicimos en la Universidad de Buenos Aires. O sea, lo que hicimos fue hackear una clase. O sea, agarramos la clase. Y hicimos todo lo que no se puede hacer, que es, decidimos no tomar exámenes, no hacer control de lectura, no dar clases en el sentido tradicional, no pedir trabajos escritos, no audiovisuales, videos, darle la clase a los alumnos para que ellos se empoderaran. Y todas las cosas que dijo, que no es lo que hacer, en general es trabajar con un trabajo de un derecho informal. Por eso yo creo que no tengo nada. Bueno, el gran desafío es llevar estas estrategias bastante anarquistas, en nombre del PAN, llevarlas a las clases convencionales, ¿no? Y en ese libro donde hizo el prólogo, en el proyecto Facebook de la Post Universidad, que está ahí, y se puede bajar, porque hace minutos que lo subieron en la Fundación Telefónica de España, y se puede bajar entero, está el prólogo de él. Entonces ahí van a ver cómo este proyecto se puede llevar efectivamente adelante dentro de espacios institucionales que lo prohíben, no quieren, no les interesa, etc. La reacción de las autoridades, del decano, etc., es mirar para otro lado, hacerse los distraídos, o tolerarlo, digamos. No van a hacer una política con eso. Y no estoy diciendo que ustedes ponen a sus plantas y hacer lo mismo. No tal vez así, pero se puede hacer mucho más lo que hacen. Y tiene que ver con esos intersticios o con esas dudas. Y yo lo sé, eso no lo digo como hipótesis, sino lo digo a partir del trabajo que vi el año pasado en el Norwich, que está haciendo Gabriela Pandiero, ¿no?
The students are so standardized and it's so difficult. When you give the students the opportunity to manage their own learning, that's what I do with them. They are always waiting for you to tell them what to do.
Yep.
It's so difficult to get the other way around. I mean, I teach the sign of knowledge. It's a subject where the students are supposed to manage their own learning, their own production. Some are not expected to be told what to do.
No, we had the same experience as during the Buenos Aires.
The first
3-4 classes, they didn't want to do it.
Yeah.
We want lectures. We want theory. We want authors. We want to read. We want to write. We want to do exams. We want the same conventional thing. So we said, we are not going to do it. If you don't like it, you just leave. Go to another course, whatever. Which is not really something you should be allowed to say or to do. But nonetheless, we did it. And after 4 or 5 weeks, they start shifting their views, they start accepting. And once they start to do the videos, and they show the videos, and some videos are really very professional, very fantastic. The other ones, that's all good. They began to compete among them to do better things. And so all of a sudden, they change their mindset, and they start working in their life. But the teachers have to stand the protest, the resistance, and the uninterest of the students. You have to go forward anyway. And it takes a lot of stamina, a lot of strength to support. But it works.
It does work. I'm not going to find this in the time I want to find it, but I have a set of photographs from, here we go, Kuala Lumpur, where I did a 2-day session. And so here they are on the first day. All right. Everybody's waiting for instruction. They're all seated at their desks. They're following along. That's day one. And they were very much sort of in the mode where, as you say, they're not self-directed. Here's how they were at the end of the second day. So you can do it. Even with people who very much have been brought up with the mindset not to do it, people can and will take control of their own learning when given the chance and when given the tools and the capacities to do it. I've seen it over and over and over. The EduCamp, again, is a wonderful example of that, and I've got photos of the EduCamps as well. Where, they start off, they look pretty much, me talking to them, them listening. By the end of it, chaos is wonderful.
Any problem they can blame you or Alejandro?
Oh, yeah. And many do.
Okay. Dear people, thank you very much for coming. I hope you have enjoyed. For us, it's been a pleasure having you on such an honor.